My dear friends, Purim is a very happy and beautiful festival. It celebrates the triumph of total good over total evil. And the story of Purim is of such significance and contains so many valuable lessons, admonitions, that we were commanded to make sure that it is read every year in every province and country, and in every family. In this Megillah of Esther, which is read in our synagogues on Purim, there are four principal characters: Ahasuerus, the king, and Haman, Mordecai, and Esther. The first two illustrate the nature of hate and the consequences of hate. The latter two illustrate the nature of love and the consequences of love. Ahasuerus, the rabbi said, was a fool. Ahasuerus tipish haya. Haman, the Megillah designates as a knave, a wicked man. Haman hara hazeh. Mordecai's name, the rabbi suggested, indicated that he was as refined and noble as pure myrrh, taking the first two letters of his word, Mordecai. And Esther's name called to their mind the morning star, which sheds its light after all the other stars have ceased to shine. Now, why did the rabbis regard the great Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, who ruled over a vast empire of 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia? Why did they call him a fool? Not only because he was unstable and intemperate and easily swayed by cunning courtiers, but because he gave way to blind and unreasoning hatred when his pride was hurt. And the first chapter of the Megillah tells the story of how this mightiest ruler of the earth allowed a sense of outraged dignity, for which he himself was responsible, to cause the downfall of his beloved queen. Ahasuerus and his boon companions, the princes and the nobles of his realm, had been enjoying a seven-day feast in the gardens of the king's palace, where royal wine was in abundance and drinking was unconfined. The king was high in spirits, and when his heart was merry with wine, he boasted before all his guests that his queen Vashti was the most beautiful woman in the world. And to prove his point, he had the queen summoned to display to the people and the princes her beauty without any apparel whatsoever, the commentators add. The queen refused to come. In so many words, she told the messengers who came to fetch her, "Say to Ahasuerus, have you lost your mind by too much drinking? I am Vashti, the daughter of Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, who was so mighty that he scoffed at kings and unto whom princes were a derision. And even you yourself would not have been deemed worthy to run before my father's chariot as a courier. What do you mean by demanding that I appear undressed in public?" And at this, the king became very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Vashti had hurt his pride. She had made him contemptible in the eyes of his subjects. "They are probably laughing at me at this very moment," he thought. "What of my majesty? What of my dignity? How dared she do such a thing to me, her husband, and her king?" And instantly, his love for her and his pride in her turned into hate. And goaded on by his counselors, some of whom presumably had trouble of their own with their wives who were not very subservient to their authority, he banished Vashti from his presence, gave her royal estate to another. Some say that he had her put to death. And later, this foolish king, who was betrayed by his own folly, actually had a decree issued, mind you, and published throughout his kingdom that hereafter every man should be master in his own house, and that all wives should henceforth give homage and obey their husbands, both great and small. Now, how silly can a man get? And here is one illustration of why men hate. Hurt pride. Hurt pride. Men and women are likely to forget almost any hurt which is done to them, but not when their pride is hurt. Their pride may be a false pride, but an imaginary one. It doesn't matter. A mortal blow has been struck to their ego. Their coveted self-esteem, their status, their armor, so to speak, has been pierced. They have been made vulnerable, even contemptible, they fear, in the sight of other people. And so they hate, with an unreasoning hate, those who have brought this humiliation, this shame as they see it, upon them, and they then proceed to vent their dudgeon, their blind fury, upon those who hurt their pride. But suppose a man were not obsessed with false pride and vanity. Suppose a man's peace of mind and serenity of spirit did not depend upon the opinion which other men had of him. Suppose he was ensconced in his own integrity and confident that his work, whatever it was intrinsically good, and the interests and enterprises of his life were sufficiently worthwhile that he need not be concerned with what other people thought of him. And that he need not maintain a facade, a precarious posture, as it were, in the eyes of others. Would such a man feel crushed and rebuffed when someone crossed him or denied him or sharply criticized him? Would he come to hate those who disagreed with him or disobeyed him or reproved him with a destroying hatred, as though they had robbed him of something extremely precious to him and indispensable to his self-respect, his inner dignity, his self-esteem? Ahasuerus was a fool. And Haman was not only a fool, clever fool, cunning fool, but a fool nevertheless. But he was also a hostile and wicked man. Ish haraze, ish tzoreir. In him, the hate, which also derived from hurt pride, Haman's hatred too derived from hurt pride, but in him this hate swelled and expanded and proliferated until it included falsehood and calumny and deception, and until it embraced not only the destruction of the one individual who hurt him, who hurt his pride, but the entire race to which that individual belonged. Now, Haman was evidently an upstart. He had been suddenly promoted by the king and advanced to a very high position above all other princes. He was greatly puffed up, evidently, by this high honor which had come to him, this eminence. And he loved to have people bow down to him, prostrate themselves before him. That was proof to him of his importance. And when he was told that Mordecai, the Jew, did not bow down to him, he became full of wrath. And then one can imagine how his anger boiled over when somewhat later, we read in the Megillah, the king consulted him on what should be done to the man whom the king delighted to honor. The king had read one night when he could not sleep in the chronicles of the kingdom that a certain Mordecai had saved his life by revealing a plot against him. And so now the king was consulting Haman as to what to do with a man whom the king delighted to honor. And Haman, in his self-centered egoism, quickly jumped to the conclusion that the king had him in mind. And he therefore quickly responded, "Why, let the man be dressed in the royal apparel which the king wears," because that was Haman's real ambition. "Let him be dressed in the royal apparel which the king wears, and let him be placed on the horse which the king rides, and let a royal crown be set upon his head, and let one of the king's most noble princes lead that man in state through the streets of the city and proclaim, 'Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" But when the king said to Haman, "Haman, make haste and do that which you have just now suggested to Mordecai the Jew," Haman was, of course, shocked and shattered. And after he had led Mordecai, whom he already hated, because Mordecai would not bow down to him, after he had led Mordecai through the streets of the city, he felt utterly disgraced and degraded, and he hastened ashamed and with his head covered to his house. and his hatred knew no bounds. It would not be enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. All of Mordecai's race throughout the entire kingdom must be destroyed. Now in Haman, we see the prototype of the 20th century Hitler. Haman is the first advocate of genocide, killing a whole race, destroying entire people to satisfy your personal grudge and be sure to rationalize your hatred to the world. Haman formulated the first genocide rationale, which was copied in one form or another by all subsequent enemies of the Jews. There is a certain people, it told the king, scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it does not profit the king to suffer them to live. If it please the king, let a decree be issued that they be destroyed. Haman revealed nothing of his real motives to the king, his personal grudge, his spleen, his malice, his desire for revenge. Not at all. He put it on a high level. His duty to let the king know that there's a certain people in his empire which is secretly plotting against him, disobeying his laws, seeking his downfall, enemies of the state. The state was in danger. Let the king beware and take action to protect his kingdom. And the foolish king, to whom a number of people more or less in his vast realm was of little account, told Haman, go ahead, do with those Jews as you wish. Now why did Haman hate so violently? He must have been terribly insecure in himself. He did not feel equal to the high post to which he had been suddenly elevated. He probably knew himself to be inferior and inadequate. And any outward indication that other people thought so too frightened him and therefore angered him. And forthwith, in self-defense, he resolved to liquidate these people who were a threat to him and eradicate every trace of them. This mad hate, my dear friends, this paranoia brought on by hurt pride and sickly apprehension might have destroyed an entire peaceful and law-abiding people innocent of any wrongdoing. And the providential intervention of two people who did not hate, but who loved, averted the kind of ghastly tragedy which unfortunately was not averted in the days of Hitler. Haman's hateful design boomeranged, destroyed himself and his entire household. Now, this kind of hate is not unique to any one man or to any one age. It manifests itself sometimes in masses of people. A people can go mad with unreasoning hate. When its pride is hurt, or when it has suffered defeat and smarts under the sense of defeat, or when he thinks that its position is being endangered. We had a manifestation of it a few years ago in our own country, in Little Rock, and more recently at Oxford, Mississippi. In last month's issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, Archibald MacLeish wrote an article which he called, "Must We Hate?" And I quote from this article the following sentences. "I think for myself what shocked me, sickened me, was the black pit of public hatred into which I looked. The black pit of public hatred into which I looked. I had known, of course, that racial hatred existed in this country as it exists elsewhere. I knew, of course, that there were presumably educated and visibly well-to-do men and women in the South and elsewhere who looked down on Negroes, because I had met such men and women. I knew there were college graduates with enough intelligence to write books who believed or said they believed that all Negroes are biologically inferior to all whites. I realized that there were people who called themselves Christians who knew that God intended the black man to be a hewer of wood and a drawer of water to the white man, any white man, of any qualification, or none, particularly none. But I also believe that these people, I also believe these people to be what they so obviously were, waifs and strays from the great process of history, who needed to find somebody or other to look down on in order to look up to themselves. And I never doubted that in an actual test between these petulant opinions on the one side and the Republic on the other, the opinions would wither away in shame and disappear. But what happened in Oxford was that they did not wither away. They stared back at you out of young men's faces, ugly with spite. They spat back at you out of the faces of middle-aged men whose words would have been incredible if you had not heard them. Now, the key sentence to which I should like to draw your attention in this statement is, I also believe these people to be what they were, so obviously were, waifs and strays from the great process of history, who needed to find somebody or other to look down on in order to look up to themselves. The driving motive behind the hatred of these men was not James Meredith, the Negro who had applied for admission to the university and whom not a single student in the University of Mississippi had ever seen. Not a single member of the mob which rioted that night could have told you what he looked like. It was enough that he was a Negro. By seeking admission to the university, he was asserting his equality as an American citizen. He was depriving the white man of the cherished pride of his assumed superior status, his eminence. He was being made equal, the white man, with the Negro, whose low degree had for so long automatically lifted him up in the white man's own estimation. And this threatened the white man with a loss of status and drove the Mississippians from their governor down defy openly and recklessly the Constitution, the Supreme Court of the United States, to defy United States Marshals and United States troops, and to defy all the democratic principles and traditions of a free America. It was this hurt pride, the threatened position, that made them ruthless and brutal. Now, fortunately, there are men and women in our land and elsewhere who do not hate. And fortunately, they are in the majority. Fortunately, every age produces leaders and followers like Mordecai and Esther, long ago in ancient Persia, who are not worried about personal status, who are not thinking of themselves exclusively, but who are concerned with the rights of other men, and even of those who belong to minorities. Mordecai was an independent spirit, a loyal Jew who loved his people, and he would not bend the knee to anyone but God. And as soon as he heard of the decree of extermination which had been issued against his people, he went into action. He thought nothing of himself, consequences to himself, his own position. He went quickly into action. And he sent word to Esther, his orphan cousin whom he had adopted as his daughter. And who was now the queen of Ahasuerus, having displaced Vashti. And he called upon her forthwith to go to the king, to go to him even if she were not summoned, to go to him even if it put her life in jeopardy. And he told her to reveal her identity as a Jewess and to plead for the lives of her people. And Esther, risking everything, her position as queen, her very life, went to the king, and love, loyalty, conquered all fear. Esther too was not thinking of herself. And because of her intercession, the death decree was annulled, and the people were saved. Now, my dear friends, there is no cure for hate. None at all. Except love. Love which derives from a sense of consideration for other people. Love which is a supreme expression of a sense of justice in regards to all other people. When man stops thinking of himself, his reputation, his status, his pride, his rights, and begins to think of others, and what he can do, not to them, but for them, he ceases to hate. A man must shift the center of gravity of his life's concern of interest from himself, from his ego, to others, including himself. Then he will come to be a just man, and he will come to be a man who will go beyond the boundaries of justice to compassion and forgiveness love. I destroy my enemy, said Abraham Lincoln. I destroy my enemy when I make him my friend. And truer words were never spoken. This is one of the great messages of this beautiful and happy festival of Purim. A festival which underscores the confidence of man in the ultimate triumph, not of hate, in the ultimate triumph of love. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Love the stranger as thyself.